There's that whole thing about you need to be running your own race, really, not comparing yourself to anyone else, because everyone's got a different start point and everyone has a different end point. So if you constantly compare yourself to everyone else, it's just a recipe for madness.
Hello and welcome to the IXDA Sydney MP podcast, a show that guides you through the stages of design mentorship, whether you're just starting out and looking or you're a seasoned designer. I'm Molly Lewis, and in this episode, Sam and Vanita are talking to Paul Blake about imposter syndrome, why it is rife within designers, and ways to approach overcoming this inner critic. Paul Blake is a human-centered designer with over 25 years of industry experience. A journalist by training, he put away his typewriter and embraced design, building his first website in 1995. He has worked internationally in a range of corporate, government, and agency environments. He majored in strategic and service design and is an enthusiastic mentor for younger designers. An ever-curious traveler, music fan, and craft beer nerd, Paul is also a spontaneous redesigner of every product and service he encounters. Let's get started.
Hi, Paul. Nice to have you with us today. How are you going?
Yeah, I'm doing very well, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Good, awesome. One question that we ask all of our guests before we get started is, how was your 2021? And are there any new habits that you'll be looking to roll into 2022?
2021, surreal, I reckon, if I was going to do it in one word. Weird sort of elasticity of time, you know. Some things that happened really recently feel like they were ages ago, and vice versa. It's just been a very strange time, I think it has for everyone. Largely, I've been working from home, well, actually for the best part of 2 years, apart from a few weeks between Melbourne lockdowns. In terms of 2022, it's important, I think, to make that as enjoyable as possible, and also on a kind of personal level as well, around just making space for things that make you smile. You know, it's become real self-evident that, like, life's short and life's transient, and things can change at a moment's notice. So make the most of the time you've got.
Awesome. And you've just recently transitioned into a new role, is that correct?
That's correct. Yeah. I've 6 weeks ago now became associate director at Frog in Melbourne, after a number of years of mainly doing my own thing in different guises.
Nice, awesome stuff. And I guess, as this podcast's about mentoring, what does it mean to you?
I mean, in terms of what I get out of it, I think it's being able to kind of help someone through a career problem, or even just a more narrow kind of design problem in a particular project. Genuinely, there's nothing that gives me greater pleasure than seeing that kind of moment where it all comes together, whether it's kind of landing the job that someone wants, or, as I say, cracking open a new technique. Or probably shouldn't say this out loud, particularly not to my new employers, but I probably gain more joy from that than delivering client work these days. But I think it can mean different things in different contexts. I mean, I kind of play a mentor role in a work, everyday kind of work context, in terms of leading projects or leading teams, but also in a outside of a formal work responsibility in kind of my own time, and just like helping people break into design or further their design careers. So I think it can have a number of different contexts.
It sounds like you've always kind of had a leg, foot, arm, finger in mentoring. So what kinds of experiences have you had, and how have mentors had an impact on you?
Well, I guess more broadly, in terms of like more formal instruction, right back into the sort of late 90s, I used to do some work around, sounds really quaint now, which is why I kind of hesitate, but helping businesses understand what the internet was all about and how they could harness the internet, right? So, and also some stuff around like software related training in things like Dreamweaver. Again, that gives away my age. And then I think I kind of edged out of that for a while, and then came back in about 4 or 5 years ago, more around formal training around user experience and human centered design. And then that's kind of led me probably more within the last 2 to 3 years in what you probably call mentoring in terms of open-ended conversations about sort of career choices and cracking open sort of techniques and things like that. So quite varied experience. Only more latterly, something that I would kind of call mentoring. Previously, much more around kind of more formal instruction. Weirdly, I've never formally sought out a particular mentor or mentors of my own, but I have been heavily influenced by people that I've worked with. I think learning a lot about things like team management, communication, and just handling difficult situations, I've learned massively from being around, from just watching how other people do it. So treating my whole career a bit like a long contextual inquiry, right? So it's like, who have I seen do that and who's done it well? And I've often ask them for informal catch-ups and conversations and going, hey, I really liked how you did X, walk me through it a little bit. But weirdly, yeah, despite the fact I did quite a lot of mentoring myself, I don't have any formal mentors at present.
So speaking of kind of formal mentoring, a little birdie has told us that you are quite active on ADP list.
I am indeed.
And so curious kind of what your experiences have been from a mentoring perspective, and yeah, what are your thoughts there?
I've met some awesome people, actually, is my number one takeaway. The real pleasure in catching up with people from literally all over the world. I've spoken to people in Europe, India, USA, as well as Australia. So that's been fascinating to get everyone else's perspective and open myself up to some different challenges and new ways of thinking, because everyone brings a different kind of question to the table. I've been heartened by the amount of sort of talent there is out there. I've been trying to encourage a lot of people that I've spoken to, seem underconfident or worry that they're not good enough or have imposter syndrome or really feel like they need to add to what they're already doing. And a lot of what I've done has been around, I think, reassuring people that where they are at the moment is perfectly good, and giving them a sense of comfort that they are doing okay. But yeah, it's just been overwhelmingly positive experience. I've massively enjoyed it so far.
So you touched on a couple of things there, the first of which was imposter syndrome, and then you also looked into some of the key topics that are brought to you within ADP list. One area that I see quite a lot is people who are just starting out in their careers to get into design. What are some of the key advice that you would give to someone who's looking to start out to use some of their experiences that isn't necessarily across design into design?
Yeah, I've kind of developed a bit of a checklist that I run those folks through. I try and like mix it up a little bit, right? I shouldn't give my whole secrets away, or otherwise I'll be no sense of mystery when I speak to everyone. But I'm always interested in people often kick off the sessions with quite a zoomed in view on things, and I always zoom them out and go, so why design? What's your passion for design? If I'm in a position where I'm hiring folks into their first position, I'm much more interested in what motivates them to be in the design industry rather than how good they are at a particular tool. So, and often that takes them by surprise and they have to go away and think about, well, why is it that I'm really into design? And it's like, well, kind of capture what that passion is and be able to articulate that passion and like in a non-cynical way, your elevator pitch is really leads with what motivates you about design. And then particularly for folks that are transitioning in from other disciplines, a lot about what's your unique value proposition. So you're bringing some things from outside of design into a design discipline. So what I've, rather than looking upon that as a barrier because you haven't done design, look upon it as a positive around what other things are you bringing to the table from other industries that might give you a head start. Or, you know, what makes you uniquely you? You know, your passion for design multiplied by your other experience is a great start point. And then start to think about where that places you in terms of what's your shortest path to that first job in the industry, because we all know that's the hardest one. Once you're in, you're in. Getting in is the problem. So thinking about your passion and thinking about your other experience, what are your shortest pathways into the industry? So if you come from a visual and graphic design background, probably your shortest pathway is something more UI related. If you're from a more sort of social sciences type background, or like myself from a journalism background, you possibly have a shorter pathway to entry through something like a research-based role. So it's like, number one, passion. Number two, what makes you uniquely you? Number three, what's your shortest pathway in? And I think only then nailing those, and then thinking about, okay, so who are the organizations, in-house teams, agencies, whatever, that are doing that type of work that aligns with where I'm at, and then actively, proactively approaching and trying to have a conversation with those folks rather than waiting for a vacancy to appear.
Nice. So it sounds almost like if you're coming from a different background other than design, you may be more likely to feel that imposter syndrome.
Yeah, yes, absolutely. I mean, speaking from personal experience, I didn't feel it at the beginning of my career because I fell into building websites in the mid-90s at the same time as everyone else was falling into it. So it felt, it was like the Wild West, you know, it's like everyone was just kind of feeling their way through it. There didn't appear to be any rules. There didn't appear to be any frameworks. But I think a lot of that was possibly a lack of self-awareness on my part, because the longer I was in the industry, then I suddenly started to discover that people have been doing like human factors and ergonomics and all of these things since Lord knows when. And then as I got more into a human-centered design user experience type role, then people from disciplines like sociology and psychology, and then all of a sudden, like the dawning realization that I'm surrounded by people who have university educations in subjects like that, let alone the people who formerly learned visual design and were in the mix as well. And then it's like, oh, hang on a minute, maybe I'm the odd one out here. And then so I think, and that might actually on reflection be why I kind of did formal instruction and then fell out of it for a while, because it's like, oh, actually, maybe I'm not qualified to say these things out loud, and maybe I go away and be quieter for a while. So it hit me mid-period of my career onwards, and even to today, I still have little flashes of it. There's always that voice in your ear going, you know, maybe you just need to, you know, not do this. Maybe someone's going to call you out on this, and you're going to end up being embarrassed about it. So maybe you should stop.
That's quite interesting. So it sounds like for you, imposter syndrome developed kind of midway through versus maybe for other designers, it starts at different points. Do you see common areas where imposter syndrome is really playing a role specifically with designers? I know we mentioned a little bit, it was maybe for designers coming from a different field and domain. Are there other areas you see them really kind of struggling with this?
Yeah, I've had a couple of conversations recently with fairly new designers who feel that, well, they fall into the trap of comparing themselves to folks that they work with. And there's that whole thing about you need to be running your own race, really, not comparing yourself to anyone else, because everyone's got a different start point and everyone has a different end point. So if you constantly compare yourself to everyone else, it's just a recipe for madness. That's manifested itself in a lot of recent conversations with younger designers feeling that they need to augment their skills. So they may have, for instance, a passion for an affinity with doing design research, and they think, I really need to learn Figma. Or they're doing wireframing and they think, well, I don't know how to facilitate design sessions with clients, and I really need to do all of this stuff because I really need to do all of it. And I think that I try and give them a sense of reassurance that, yeah, you can be generalist, but you can also be specialist. I know people who spent their whole career just doing research, says Paul, thereby making it sound like that's less valuable, or concentrating on being really good with UI. And that's perfectly reasonable to be an absolute specialist, with maybe then just minoring in one other of design aspect. No one's a hotshot at everything from stakeholder engagement through to delivering pixel perfect design. Anyone that tells you that they are probably exhibits the same lack of self-awareness that I evidently did at the beginning of my career. So it's okay to be good at one aspect of design, particularly in the early part of your career, and don't feel that you have to add in all of these other components of the industry. It's perfectly good to take your time and work out where you sit. Yeah, I think that comes from this kind of, oh well, person X can do better wireframes than me, therefore I need to be as good as that. And it's like, no, actually you don't necessarily.
I think that's a pretty awesome design philosophy to live by, both professionally and personally. Are there other design philosophies that you've kind of picked up along the way that you could share with us?
I find partly around imposter syndrome and partly just around design generally, I also find the whole notion of like embracing ambiguity. I find that a lot of even quite seasoned designers have a heightened sense of anxiety when they don't know what the answer is. And the notion that I've learned for myself and try and impart into others around, it's okay not to know what the answer is, right? Well, no, one of my former students reminded me the other day of one of my sayings that I apparently say a lot, which is you'll know when you get there. Right. So there's a moment, there's obviously a moment in your project where you will know the answer, but that's not at the beginning. Untangling all of that is part of the methodology. There's something around being comfortable with ambiguity and working your way through that and embracing it and celebrating it. And then I also think there's something around just being naturally curious, I think, on both a personal and a professional level, and understand, because that then leads you into probably the third thing, which is about understanding. We all have the mantra about you are not the user. I've come to realize over more recent years about unconscious bias and privilege and all of the things that come with that. I grew up seeing myself as not growing up someone with privilege as someone that wore a red coat and rode around on a horse hunting foxes and lived in a manor house, right? And that wasn't me, so therefore I wasn't privileged. And I've come to realize that as a white English-speaking middle-aged male, I'm pretty much holding all of the privilege cards. So therefore, when I'm in a design context, I need to work really, really hard to understand everyone else's point of view and not unconsciously steer it in a particular direction because of my worldview or assuming everyone is like me. And I think we all talk about not being the user, but there's several layers to that, and probably both on a professional and personal level. That's another thing that I think is very, very important to be hyper vigilant about.
You mentioned just a second ago that ambiguity is quite a big thing with not knowing, but isn't there a bit of a fine line between ambiguity and imposter syndrome? And as a designer, how could you potentially kind of get around those areas?
Yeah. There is, because like if you're owning up to not knowing the answer, then there's a danger that you could be perceived as not knowing what you're doing. Classic anecdote from early in my career, the first time when I'd recently discovered the power of a human-centered design approach and doing the research up front rather than just doing the usability testing at the end, I went to a very senior person within the organization that I worked for at the time and said, I need a 30 grand budget because we really need to do some research. And he said to me, why would I want to give you a research budget? I pay you to have all of the answers. Probably illustrative of your point there, Sam. So it's like, well, if I'm saying I don't know what the answer is, how can I be perceived as competent? If I don't know the answer, then I think the kind of answer to that, or my approach to that at least, is I'm confident in the methodology. I trust in them. I know the methodology. Obviously always learning and always augmenting that, but I'm comfortable with the human-centered design methodology. I know the framework to go through to arrive at the answer. So what you're getting when you work with any good set of human-centered designers is you're investing in a pathway to get to the answer, and that's where the skill and the talent lies. You're not investing in someone who's going to give you the answer straight off the bat. It's like the difference between an advertising agency and a human-centered design agency, right? You work in the advertising world. Someone comes to you with a business problem, and you're immediately on the hook to give them three potential solutions, and they pick one and they run with it. Whereas if you come to a human-centered design team, they'll go, here's the framework, we'll step through that phase by phase, and at the end of it, we'll absolutely have something of worth for you.
So chatting about ambiguity, curious to hear your thoughts. So I just read Mike Montero's Ruined by Design book. Big fan. I know one of the things that he really kind of drills into you is that the most confident answer a designer can give is, I don't know. right? And so as we're talking about ambiguity and imposter syndrome, how do you empower designers to be upfront and say that, to say, I don't know, alongside some of the things that might be happening in the background, such as politics and funding and all of that good stuff?
Yeah, I think as the leader of any design team, it's on that person to really instill in the client team what the process is. So what we will know at what point in the process. So I think it's the design lead's role to protect to a degree those less experienced designers so they aren't in the firing line from those type of questions from senior stakeholders. And I also think the other key thing is to always let your clients and stakeholders into the process, obviously formally by ensuring that they're part of kind of co-design activities alongside end users at those particular points, but also having very open dialogue. And like if you're working remotely, having a virtual design room that the clients can duck into. And if you're working on client site, literally having everything up on the wall that they can come in at any point and see where you're at and what you're doing. I think not to continually criticize the advertising industry, but here I go again. There's that notion of like the magic happens there behind the curtain. They go away and they do something and they step out from behind the curtain with a big ta-da and here it is. I think we need to do the opposite of that, which is give a running commentary at every point on where we're at and what we're thinking, what we know, what we don't know, what the next activity is, what that's going to unlock, and give a very clear illustration of what that pathway looks like and what we bed down at each point. And I think then that gives everyone within the project the license to go, well, we don't know that yet, actually. We're going to know this thing in a week or 2 weeks, and we might know that thing in a month. But that's around, I think, being really transparent about your framework and also really transparent about what your day-to-day is and where you're at and what you're thinking and letting everyone into that world.
It sounds like what you just said there, you're really valuing frameworks over tools. Are there any kind of strategies which you would suggest to really kind of hammer those through?
Yeah, I know it's old hat and everyone still references it. It's like classic sort of design council double diamond approach and being really clear on convergent and divergent thinking. So where do you have jumping off points where you're breaking it apart and exploring every possible avenue, and where are you reaching the limits of that, and then making sense of things and bringing it back into findings, points of view, and having a laser guided focus about not trying to do both those things at once, because that's where everything comes unraveled. You can't generate ideas and critique all of those ideas simultaneously. So having a clear understanding of when you're blowing something apart and having a clear understanding of where you're assembling it and bringing it back together. And the fact that you do that at several points during any project, I think that's key. That's my sort of key framework. I always try and be agile in the broader sense of the word, in terms of it's got to be this activity followed by this activity followed by this activity. It's much more around having a toolkit of techniques that you can pick from at the appropriate moment in a project. So I guess to give a practical example, you're always going to want to do some looking into the client's world at the beginning. So there's going to be some kind of desk research, and there's going to be some kind of engagement with your key stakeholders. That might be workshops, that might be interviews, that might be something else. And then you're obviously going to want to understand the customer, citizen, user landscape. So that might be interviews, that might be observation, that might be diary study. And then you're going to want to play back those findings in some way, which again might be findings documents or personas or journey maps or empathy maps or mental models or whatever. So I think being very clear about when you're breaking something apart and when you're bringing something together in terms of divergent and convergent thinking, and being flexible around picking the best tools from the toolkit to do each of those steps right the way through the process, right the way through to, you know, are you doing a service walkthrough to as a prototype, or is it something that's a digital prototype, or is it both? Are you doing an alpha and a beta release? Are you, you know, doing some form of experimentation in another way? There's a set of tools at each point. So, yeah, they're my two kind of, I don't know if you call them frameworks, but like, yeah, being very clear about when you're thinking broadly and when you're bringing it back together, and picking the right tools from the toolkit for each phase. And then it's and having the confidence to swap something out and swap something in, I guess, if during the course of the project you're thinking, you know what, I thought we were going to do this, but actually I think this other thing might give us a better outcome.
Okay. And you're obviously kind of preaching to the choir here, as we're all designers. And these frameworks are fantastic for designers, but how would you break this down when speaking to people within the business?
Mm. Yeah, really good question. Something that where design fails is where it's not got a really close relationship with meaningful business metrics. So you've got and something that I've tried to get a lot better on in the last maybe 5 to 10 years is absolutely talking the language of business. So practical examples would be around having a high level understanding of things like, you know, customer acquisition, customer retention, customer lifetime value, cost to serve, and so what is the direct business benefit of the design that we're putting forward? Is the business benefit in around driving efficiency? Is it going to acquire more customers? Is it going to give a bigger share of the wallet? Whatever it might be, having a real focus on talking the language of business and appending really rigorous metrics. And then I think the other thing to really bridge that gap is I've had numerous opportunities, thankfully not where I was responsible for this deliverable, but numerous times, I should say, where I've worked inside organizations and they've got some enormous service blueprint or customer journey map on the wall that looks awesome, but the client has literally no idea how to operationalize any of that. There's no framework, there's no horizons. And so essentially they probably spent, you know, $500,000 on a piece of artwork, right? Which might be okay if it's a Banksy, but if it's a customer journey map done by agency X, it's probably never going to realize its value. So the roadmap to go with the, you know, the practical roadmap, implementation, execution, how to operationalize it. So make sure your design lives in the real world, and make sure that your design decisions are related to hard and fast business metrics. That, I think, bridges the gap.
That's quite interesting. So you kind of mentioned previously how design has a way of making sure there's diverse perspectives taken into it to make sure that you're designing for the user. You've also talked about how you know, we're designing for reality, essentially. So, you know, as designers, we try to not be in an echo chamber, but we also have to speak the business language. And sometimes the business side of things is in an echo chamber. So how do you kind of start to merge those things together? I know you talked a little bit about how design might have business metrics around that. So can you speak a little bit about that, and like, what about things that aren't measurable as well?
Some of that is around making sure you have a cross-disciplinary team. So design is a very broad field. So making sure there are folks on the team that maybe bring that business rigor to bear and keep the team accountable. So the design team is, like I say, is pretty broad. So that's part of it. And then equally making sure you interface and actively engage broadly across the business. So if you're like, we generally get engaged by either marketing related folks or IT related folks, depending on who holds the budget in large organizations, right? So that's great, but you've got to make sure that you engage widely across the business. I mean, there's the classic example, right? The legal team always gets criticized by designers because they swoop in at the last minute and put the handbrake on the wonderful design just before it's going live. Well, there's a really good reason for that. It's because no one asked them their opinion early on in the piece, and obviously their job is to mitigate risk. And if they turn up the day before something goes live and they've got no idea what it's about, they can pull a handbrake on it. It's their job. So making sure your own team has a broad range of skills, and making sure that your project consults broadly and deeply with within the client space to make sure everyone has an input, and then practically involving those folks in activities through co-design and through ideation, co-design, and giving them a window into the iterative design. I think that all helps.
So to kind of avoid the what I call the scoop and poop, how do you bring everyone along on that journey, but then also balance it with not ideally not doing a design by committee?
Yeah, classic one on that. I remember years ago when most usability testing was done in a lab, I had like the senior stakeholder came in for one session and watched it on the other side of the glass, and it was the one session out of 20 where the person actually liked the product. And so when I went back and delivered the bad news around, well, you know what, this thing just failed terribly. It's like, what do you mean? It was working perfectly well when I was there. And I said, well, only one out of 20 people liked it. And they said, well, obviously the other 19 weren't our customers. You need to go back and retest it with some people who are actually our customers, you know? So that unhelpful intervention by very senior stakeholders is real and does happen. I think part of that is always being clear on who's got sign off. And often those people are extremely senior and therefore can't or won't devote the time to be hands-on on the project that they need to be able to make an informed decision. So, like, depending on how much leverage you've got, you either go, well, you know, we can't proceed unless you can devote X number of hours per week to this project, right? Which very occasionally you get, but most of the time you don't. So then I think it's around having candid conversations up front around, well, who's got delegated sign, who are you comfortable with freeing up to be part of this project, who you trust to give sign off. So again, you're not coming in at the end and something you see makes you nervous, so therefore you won't give sign off on it because you can't have an informed decision. That's where most of this comes from. I'm sure people don't want to wreck things at the end of projects just for the sake of it. It's because they're worried, right? Their reputation within the business is on the line, or their metrics are on the line, or their their bonus is on the line, or whatever it might be, right? So, okay, well, if they can't devote the time, who do they trust? Who are they going to devolve sign off to? Where those folks are able to free up time to be part of the process, but also senior enough or have the trust of those very, very senior people that, oh, if person X said it was okay, then that's no problem, we can go with it. So I think that's how you avoid that design. Partly that covers off the kind of single senior stakeholder swooping in and wrecking it. The committee part of it is around, well, if there are multiple people that need to sign it off, then that goes back to just involving them in the process and making them, ensuring that they are part of that design process and have ownership in the solution, and people are much more comfortable if they feel that they've contributed to and therefore have real ownership of it. Ownership then gives people a sense of comfort, and they kind of let the handbrake off a little bit. So I think it's like really all of that is set at the beginning of a project. So who's got sign off? Are those people going to be available? If not, who are you going to devolve sign off to? Because we don't want to get ourselves in a situation where you, person X, come in at the end, don't have clear sight of what we've done, feel nervous, and say we can't release it. So it's like having that candid conversation head on at the beginning.
Okay, so from what you're saying, it seems that design is the enabler, but the communication across all parties and business units is really the kind of key cog in the wheel.
Yeah.
What resources would you recommend for that? Is it just working within an agile manner, working within kind of those work streams and working with those engagement leads to make sure everything's in progress?
Yeah. I kind of see it as an account management type role, but traditionally the account management is, having slagged off the advertising industry, I'm now going to slag off the business development industry. So no one will be my friend after this. Account management traditionally has often been a sales orientated role. Understandably, people in sales orientated roles with targets are much more interested in getting pieces of work signed off than they are necessarily in how that work is going to be delivered. So that's where I think traditionally the divergence on that kind of account management has come about. And I think there absolutely has to be some of that ahead, you know, in the pre-sales and when you're setting sail. But I think there is absolutely a role within that design and delivery team for someone to have real focus on your stakeholder group and making sure that they are comfortable all the way through. And there's the communicating the nuts and bolts, you know, the classic project management role of, this is what we said we do this week, and we either are doing it, or we're behind, or we're ahead. But there's also that broader, and also as I've said, around involving those folks in the design activities, so they have the sense of ownership. But there is also that relationship stuff around just taking a temperature check on how people are feeling through the course of the project. And again, I think that probably sits with the design lead and a sense of awareness for that design lead to understand that part of their job just making sure everyone's on board and feels comfortable and doesn't have a sense of anxiety over anything. And again, part of that is around like contextual inquiry around unofficially around how everyone's acting and behaving, but also it's around proactively making sure that you're asking those questions like, are you comfortable? Is this going where you expected it to go? The answer is always no, of course, because we don't know what we don't know. But when it does go to those places, like, how are you feeling about that? Are you still okay? Is there anything that's making you nervous? And really proactively doing that account management through the process, as distinct from just making sure that the project's on track and just making sure that everyone within the design team is doing their thing.
It sounds like taking the stakeholder or the client along the way in the journey is vital. Yes. How important is change management when delivering a big style program for those stakeholders to eventually adopt what you're designing as a final outcome?
Yeah, I think it's absolutely vital. And I do change management in the broadest sense of, I understand what the gap is between where the organization is now and where it needs to be. But I'm having an ongoing sort of personal thought process and also a good dialogue with design teams around the role of a change management person on the design team when it gets into the ideation and then test and implementation around, well, shouldn't overlook that that's a specialist role, because obviously change makes people, this is same again, change makes people uncomfortable. So whether that's your stakeholders around, I'm not sure I can release this because I'm not sure what's going to happen to, you know, my bonus, my metrics, etc. It obviously impacts a whole bunch of other folks within the business, particularly if your change is quite radical. So you wouldn't dream of doing a project, or you shouldn't dream of doing a project without having some technical expertise on in terms of what does the tech stack look like. So if service design operates at a people, process and technology layer, then you need to have folks on your team who are expert in people and process and technology, and change management's very much around, well, what does that mean for the people going forward? So whether that's something around as designers having more of a change management toolkit, or whether that means having a specialist change management person on the project, that's open to some debate, but certainly having that is something which is absolutely covered off with just as much rigor as understanding the tech stack, I think is vital.
That's pretty awesome. I think change management is something that a lot of designers do as their side jobs in addition to their normal, yeah, all of the other things that they have to do. So what recommendations do you have for designers maybe looking to go into change management? And then kind of on the other side, change management is usually a long-term role. You know, you're really embedded potentially in the program or project of work. How do you keep them motivated and inspired?
Yeah, I think taking the last part first, I think some, in my experience, I've had members of the design team who are really interested in that change management function. So they're proactively interested in doing more of it. And so they're motivated just by curiosity and interest anyway. In terms of designers getting closer to that, I have found that certainly thinking about internal teams, most larger organizations have a suite of learning opportunities for you as employees. So they can be your standard things like Word and PowerPoint and whatnot. But most organizations also have some stuff around Lean and stuff around Agile and some stuff around change management as well. So there's often opportunity, particularly if you work in an internal team, to put your hand up for those types of training. I've done previous roles where I've been overseeing teams. I've had on those occasions, yeah, people have an interest in, people within the design team having an active interest in going, you know what, we should be looking after this change management stuff. Yeah, we absolutely should. Do you fancy doing a bit more of that? And then them doing internal courses. For those folks that are on agency side, again, most agencies will have some kind of training budget, and there are heaps of publicly available courses on change management. So if it floats your boat, then I say grab your training budget and dive into some of that publicly available stuff. And in the same way as if the sort of language of business interests you as well as it should, then again, there are opportunities to get sort of formal training and exposed to those disciplines.
And what areas can someone go into broaden their outlook? And do you know any resources which you kind of hang your hat on?
There are a couple of sort of, from the business side of things, DMBA, Design MBA, that they do, like, they do a really cool free sort of 7-day email related course where they just email you every day with some business basics. I find that one dead useful when I tried that. I know they do more formal training as well, and I know I haven't experienced it personally, but I know other designers who have and have found that great. Change management, I'm less across I know some of the frameworks, but who was great at training them, I wouldn't feel necessarily qualified to give you an opinion on. But they're certainly out there. I know people who know people, right? So I can always point people in the right direction, but wouldn't have a particular training course to hand that I would recommend.
No worries at all.
So as we are starting the new year of 2022, what recommendations do you have for habits or things for inspiration to keep designers going?
I think really it's around understanding, like, and this will change from each individual's perspective, but understanding the things about working remotely that you want to hold on to, and the bits that you never want to see again. I mean, I know personally I went through a bit of a roller coaster to begin with. It's like, awesome, I particularly as I do a lot of my work for clients in Melbourne, and I live about an hour and 20 minutes train ride outside of Melbourne. It's like, awesome, I can sit here in my spare room in my jogging pants, as long as I've got a smart shirt on and don't stand up at any point, and like do my job, and that's great, and I don't have to get on the train and I don't have to go anywhere and I'm so much more productive. And then I kind of dipped into that's great, and I'm lucky enough to live in the countryside and plenty of fresh air and everything, but then it's starting to get a little bit lonely, you know, not hanging out with people, and it's like, oh, I wish I could. So it's like there's a balance to be struck there. So my personal takeaway is around, well, what bits of that do I want to hold on to, which would be probably not traveling in every day and not feeling like I've got to go in to an office where all I am doing then is being in a meetings from 9 to 5, because I can do that from here. But also, what are the things that really resonate to be done in person, and also making those times really memorable and really fun. So if we are all coming together and everyone is all coming into the office and we are going to assemble, what are the things that make that really fun and really meaningful and really worthwhile? And I think that will vary from person to person and team to team, but I think going into it, we've been through such a roller coaster, it's very easy to just trash everything that's happened in the previous year or the previous 2 years. But I think it's worth sort of taking a moment to think about, well, what are the things that I want to hold on to and what are the things that I don't want to do again, and use those two things collectively to kind of fashion out what your toolkit and your ways of working look like for the new year and beyond.
Thank you very much, Paul. That was a really good session, and really loved some of the answers that you provided. I've been kind of writing stuff down, and we'll definitely be listening to this back.
And that concludes the latest episode of the IXDA Sydney MP podcast. If you want to learn more about IXDA Sydney's events and their mentorship programs, please visit ixdasydney.org. See you next time, everyone.
I'm Paul Blake, and you've been listening to the Sydney IXDA MP pod.